We're going to be covering some stuff on Herod this morning. So I have a handout here that I will pass out here shortly. Gerald gets his first. But we'll get to that here in just a little bit. All right. All right, let's turn over in our Bibles to Acts. Chapter 25. So we've been working through Paul's time in Caesarea, spent approximately 2 years there after, of course, being arrested in Jerusalem. Last time we talked a little bit about some of the rulers that were in the time or in the region that Paul had to deal with. We talked a little bit about Felix and how he was not exactly what you would call a very good ruler. We talked about how he was recalled in 59-60 AD, something like that. Talked about his wife, Drusilla, and some of the things that she had done, and the fact that she was not exactly what you would call a good, righteous, and godly woman. Of course, he wasn't a good, righteous, and godly man either, so surprise, surprise. Talked a little bit about how Felix would know more about the way of Christianity and some of the influences that were there. Of course, remember that they were in Caesarea. Talked about some of the events that had occurred in Caesarea with, say, Philip the Evangelist, and of course, Cornelius and his household having been converted and living in Caesarea. We also talked a little bit about how Felix really didn't find anything worthy of death in Paul after he had heard the Jews' concerns and charges against him. But Felix decided that this was a great time to extort some money out of Paul and out of the church, and decided to keep him in prison. Although, while he was in prison, he was given quite a bit of freedom. Essentially, he was assigned a soldier to watch him 24 hours a day. He couldn't necessarily leave, but people could come and talk to him and minister to him, as Luke records in the book of Acts. Talked a little bit about when Paul had the opportunity to talk to Felix and Drusilla, talked about the message that he delivered to them, and that he kind of hit on the things that probably made him a little uncomfortable. He talked about righteousness and self-control and, you know, not stealing another man's wife in not so many words. But talked a little bit about what he presented to Felix and to Drusilla. And of course, we know that, as I mentioned, after about 2 years of this, Felix was recalled and then was replaced by a guy named Festus. Now, Festus, as we talked about again last week, we don't know a lot about him. There's really not a lot in the historical accounts of Festus outside of the New Testament and a few other miscellaneous things. Josephus does mention some additional details about his reign as governor. We know that Festus stepped into some political and religious turmoil when he took over from Felix. Remember, Felix was going to go on trial because of the charges brought against him by the Jewish nation, and that was part of the reason why Felix ended up leaving Paul in prison. But Festus had a mess to clean up. We know that while he was the procurator, I don't know why I can't say that word, but anyway, we know that during his time under King Agrippa II, King Agrippa added that second story to the palace so that he could overlook the temple and the Jews and built a bigger wall. And yeah, it seems rather childish to me, but I wonder if they had to get a permit for that. You know, anyway, so. And then, of course, that was one of the things that Festus ended up having to deal with. We talked a little bit about how Nero's wife decided, basically, was able to convince Nero that the Jews could have their wall. But anyway, long story short, Festus dies suddenly in Israel in 62 AD, and then he was later succeeded by Albinus. So, at this point, we're here in Acts chapter 25. We're going to start here in verse 1. This is while Paul has his trial being arranged. So Festus, remember, he's stepped into a rather tumultuous time. And he's got a lot he's got to deal with. And it's funny that Festus, when he goes to Jerusalem, what one of the things that he encounters there. Super Dave?
Are you
going to
address the question?
Yes. Yes. I'll cover that in just a bit. So, Festus comes into the situation, and we'll pick it up here in verse 1. Okay? So, Acts chapter 25, verse 1. Festus then, having arrived in the province 3 days later, went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. And the chief priests and the leading men of the Jews brought charges against Paul, and they were urging him, requesting a concession against Paul, that he might have him brought to Jerusalem, at the same time setting an ambush to kill him on the way. Festus then answered that Paul was being kept in custody at Caesarea, and that he himself was about to leave shortly. Therefore, he said, let the influential men among you go there with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them prosecute him. Okay, so 3 days after Festus arrives in Caesarea, he goes down to Jerusalem. Now, Caesarea, of course, as we've talked about, was the usual residence for Roman governors, so that was kind of the provincial head. That's where they would stay. Festus goes down to Jerusalem to see the city. You know, if you think about it, Jerusalem was a major city in historical, in that time, in a historical relevance. It is today to a certain extent, but you know, if you're a Roman, you probably hear about Rome an awful lot, and you hear about Jerusalem an awful lot. Okay, so he wanted the opportunity to go down and to see the city and the temple that had been built by Herod the Great. I mean, the temple that Herod built was magnificent. It wasn't Solomon's temple by any means, but it was a costly venture, and it was beautiful, and it was covered in gold, and I mean. It was a beautiful building. And of course, the other reason he goes down to Jerusalem is he wants to go down and get informed on what's really going on. He wants to get his finger on public affairs. And the best way to do that is to visit there, to go and understand, to talk to the leaders, and to see what the city is doing, and so on and so forth. He wanted to go and become familiar with what was going on and what he stepped into. So while he's in Jerusalem, Festus is petitioned by the high priest and other chief men. So you see this in verses 2 and 3, specifically chief priests and the leading men of the Jews. So we can assume that this is essentially the same group that had brought the charges against Paul to Caesarea in the first place. And of course, while they're there, they ask to send Paul to Jerusalem. Now, you have to understand the political situation in this particular time. And again, you look at the statue in Daniel with the four world kingdoms, and you look at the last one. What was unique about the feet? Do you remember? Iron mixed with clay. And what was that about? Not some new alloy, that's for sure. It was brittle. It was two completely different items trying to mix together, and it didn't work. It was very fragile. So in Jerusalem, you would have, obviously, the very strong religious Jewish influence and them wanting to do their own thing. The Romans, of course, were the other side of that coin. They're the ones who controlled the area. They're the ones who controlled the land. They're the ones who collected the taxes. They're the ones who did all of the things that they wanted to do, and they allowed the Jews to do what they wanted to do in terms of religious matters. So when the men come up and approach Festus, they want to take control back of this particular situation with Paul, because they'd lost control of it for at least a couple years while Paul was in custody. So they want to regain control here. And of course, their goal is to kill Paul along the way. You know, their hate for Paul had not diminished since the events 2 years previous. They hated this guy. They hated what he represented. And we can assume, although we can't make a 100% one-to-one connection, we can assume that the same guys who had made the vow to kill Paul from Acts chapter 23 are probably the same guys who are willing to do it this time. But Festus was a smart man. I think he has a certain amount of knowledge about the way that these things happen and about what's going on. And so he's like, no, Paul's already in Caesarea. I'm going up there anyway. He's going to stay there. Okay. And of course, according to Roman law, it says you got to bring your accusations against him up there. So verses 4 through 6, Festus arranges for the trial at Caesarea. He, of course, mentions that he should be kept there. Festus is going to go back up there anyway. And Paul, the accusers of Paul are invited to come up and present their charges. And this is so important, because Festus could have easily, to please the Jews, because remember, the Jews were in conflict with the Romans all the time. They had just gotten Felix basically pulled from his post. So Festus could have gone, oh yeah, sure, this will please you, here you go. But Festus valued the Roman law and knew that Paul should not be handed over without hearing more. So, of course, Festus returns to Caesarea, and Paul is brought before him and the tribunal. In the King James, it'll say, and in the Rotherhams, it'll say judgment seat. So let's pick it up here in verse 6. I'll just read verses 6 and 7 real quickly, because I want to make a couple of points here. Actually, let's go down through verse 12, and then we'll come back and make some comments. All right, verse 6. After he had spent not more than 8 or 10 days among them, he went down to Caesarea, and on the next day, he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. After Paul arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him, which they could not prove. While Paul said in his own defense, I have committed no offense, either against the law or of the Jews, or against the temple, or against Caesar. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? But Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to the Jews, as you also very well know. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of those things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Then when Festus had conferred with his council, he answered, you have appealed to Caesar? To Caesar you shall go. So the Jews from Jerusalem, they bring their charges against Paul, and of course they can't prove them, just as they couldn't the first time. Some of the language that's used here in verse 7, specifically about him, standing around him, or they stood around him, it implies that there were a lot of Jews that had come up from Jerusalem, or come down from Jerusalem, to present their case. Their charge, as we know from the first time that this was brought to Felix, their charge was a jumble of religious and political issues. Certainly, nothing deserving death under the Roman law. As, remember what Lysias the commander said? It's like, I really don't know what's going on here. I don't know why these guys don't like him. So I don't know why they're asking for his head. This doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm sending him to you. Okay? So Lysias couldn't find anything wrong with him. Felix couldn't find anything wrong with him. Festus, as we'll see, can't find anything wrong with him. So the Jews can't prove their case. Now, this is something that we're not sure how much information was passed between Felix and Festus, but I would bet that there wasn't a whole lot of conferring between the two of them before Felix had to leave. But for whatever reason, Festus had a pretty good idea that what was going on was not accurate. Now, what's missing from this particular presentation of the case against Paul compared to the first time? Okay, they didn't mention it specifically. At least Luke doesn't record that. I would imagine that they brought that up. I think they levied the same charges, but there's something missing. Something's different. Kendall? Yeah, it doesn't look like they brought Tertullus. They didn't bring a lawyer this time. At least it doesn't look like it. Okay. Tertullus, you know, there's a few reasons for this. Tertullus, he may have been there, but Luke's precision in recording events such as these, they lead me to believe that the council representatives presented their own case and that Tertullus wasn't there. Because Luke's so precise in what he records, I would find it hard to believe that if Tertullus had presented it, that Luke wouldn't have mentioned it. That's my opinion. But if Tertullus wasn't there, it could be that the Jews decided that Tertullus didn't do a good enough job, and they figured that they could present their case better than Tertullus could. Could be. And it also could be that Tertullus figured out, this is a losing case, I don't want it. So it could be any number of things, but it seems to me that Tertullus was not there to make those charges. Of course, Paul denies, in verse 8, he denies any offense against the law, the temple, or Caesar. And of course, you remember back to the charges that were initially brought against him from Acts chapter 21, verse 28, where the Jews from Asia were like, hey, he's brought these men into these Philistines, these Gentiles, into the temple, and he's defiled this holy place. Now, the charges that were brought against him then were simply religious. But I think it's interesting that Paul says, I haven't done anything against not only the Jewish law, but I've done nothing against Caesar either. So what do you think it is that, why do you think Paul had to say that? I mean, again, we're connecting some things that I think to a certain extent are my opinion, because I can't prove them 100%. But Paul said that he didn't do anything against Caesar. Well, what did Caesar have to do with the temple? Nothing. Really? Just a building, in Caesar's mind anyway. So what do you think it was? Why do you think Paul mentioned that? Super Dave?
If you go back to earlier when Jesus was accused of not paying homage to Caesar, you know, it could be that Paul is being accused of not paying homage to Caesar, but to the temple only. And Paul knows enough about the Romans, because he is a Roman, mm-hmm. So he knows enough that he's got to pay his homage to Caesar and to God. Just as it says in Scripture, to give to Caesar what is Caesar's, mm-hmm. and to God what is God's.
Yeah, so I think that's part of it. I think the big one is that they were trying, I think the Jews didn't really fully appreciate, obviously, who Jesus was. And remember what it was? Remember how they approached Jesus? You know, remember, what was that conversation that Jesus had with one of those rulers guys that said, are you the king of the Jews? I think they were accusing Paul of preaching a king other than Caesar, which he was. But it wasn't in violation of, if you will, Roman law, because honestly, the gospel and the law of the scripture is above Roman law. So Paul certainly didn't violate anything in that regard, but I think that was one of the charges that were being brought against him, that specifically to try to get Paul put to death, if nothing else, by the Romans. And again, they couldn't prove any of this. So Paul denies these things, and he says, nope, I didn't do any of these things. And of course, Festus, again, being in the difficult situation that he is, verse 9, he asks, in an effort to try to please the Jews, he asks if Paul is willing to go to Jerusalem and be judged there. Remember, Festus is dealing with some pretty tangled religious and political issues here. And so he approaches Paul and says, hey, are you willing to go there? Are you willing to go to Jerusalem? Paul very wisely decides not to go to Jerusalem, and he instead appeals to Caesar. A couple of things that are interesting here, too, is that when Paul appeals to Caesar, Festus is like, you've asked, you're going. It was a right of every Roman citizen to have their case heard before Caesar. But you step back for a second, and Paul, he'd been in prison for 2 years because of these false charges brought against him by the Jews. And they want to bring him back to Jerusalem. Now, if you were this guy, if you were Paul, what would you do? Oh, yeah, sure. I'll go back to Jerusalem. Look at the justice that they mete out. No, of course not. Paul sees the malice toward him. He sees that it hasn't lessened. And he undoubtedly understands that he would not get a fair trial in Jerusalem. Now, think of the sad state of affairs when the capital of the Jewish religion would not give you a fair trial. I mean, that's a really sad state of affairs. And you can see just how far Judaism had strayed from the devotion to the law, devotion to God's word. You can see, obviously, even, you know, obviously talking about the story of Christ. There was no justice in what they did. And Paul knew he wasn't going to get any if he went there. Paul, in his assertion of his innocence, he bolsters it by his willingness to die if he had done something worthy of death. He says, sure, put me on trial. If I've done anything worthy of death, I'm willing to die. Okay? But he, of course, appeals to Caesar. Anybody know who Caesar was by this time? Nero? Okay. So Nero was Caesar by this time. And so by doing this, Paul effectively puts an end to the Jews' desire to prosecute their own case against him themselves. It was now out of their hands. And here's the neat thing. Paul's appealing to Caesar was not just for his own sake. If he won the case, it would help to legitimize Christianity or get at least official recognition as Christianity is separate from the sect of the Jews, or separate than a sect of the Jews. So Paul's appealing to Caesar gave him an opportunity to speak on behalf of himself, but also specifically on behalf of Christianity. His understanding of Roman law serves him very well, and he reminds Festus of his rights as a Roman citizen. Hey, I have this right. I appeal to Caesar. And of course, before Festus sends Paul to Rome, the governor takes advantage of an opportunity to have Paul examined by one known for his knowledge of Jewish law. And that is, of course, King Herod Agrippa II. Now, last week, Super David asked a question regarding Herod. I didn't listen carefully, because as most of you probably do, I know I'm guilty of this. When somebody's asking me a question, I don't always listen as well as I should. I'm trying to think how I'm going to respond. And I responded incorrectly. The question was basically, which one of the Herods did what? Well, when you start sitting down and you start talking about Herod, there's a whole lot of them. There's a lot of complications in there. There's a lot of interweaving of families, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But, so to that end, I did not make a whole bunch of copies. I didn't know how many people were going to be here today. But I've got about 20 copies of this House of Herod. This is just a scan from my Bible. So if you guys can maybe share these a little bit, pass them around. Like I said, I only made about 20 copies. If you wouldn't mind. This will help. This is a scan from my study Bible. I just kind of enlarged it so you can read this a little bit better. We'll work through this so that you understand which Herod did what. Now, this is not a class on all the Herods and all the things that they did, but I want you to have a good understanding of who it is that Paul is going to be speaking with in verse 13 and following. Okay? So let's just read verse 13 so you know why we're going here. It says, now when several days had elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and paid their respects to Festus. So they pay their respects to Festus because Festus had just been put into place and put into power. They came as a formal recognition of his arrival in the province. So let's talk real quickly about Herod Agrippa II. So you'll see on on that little handout, or if you have one of these in your Bible, you'll see that Herod Agrippa II is all the way to the right on this particular chart. This is the guy that Paul is speaking to. Okay? So I think the question that Super David asked last week was this the same Herod that had killed James and imprisoned Peter? Was that your question?
No.
Okay. Oh, okay. So I really didn't understand your question. So this is not the same guy who killed John the Immerser. So if you start from the right side of this chart and you go to the left, you'll see Herod Agrippa II is who Paul is talking to. The guy who killed James and imprisoned Peter is Herod Agrippa I, Herod Agrippa II's father. The guy who beheaded John the Baptist is known as Herod Antipas, okay, and would be the great or the grandfather of Herod Agrippa II, to whom Paul is speaking. And then, of course, you take one step further to the left, you have Herod the Great, who built Herod's temple, and who was the king who killed the babies and was around, of course, during the birth of Jesus. So, Paul, by this time, by the time he gets to Herod Agrippa, he will have spoken before Felix, who is recalled. And then, of course, Paul spends 2 years in captivity there because of Felix. He has already spoken before Festus. We talked about that, how he died suddenly in 62. And Festus, I think this, we'll see this in a little bit, but Festus has an interesting way of describing Paul. He says some interesting things to him. I think it reveals the nature of Festus. We'll just leave it at that. And of course, we know that Festus ends up sending Paul to Rome. But before he does that, Paul has the opportunity to speak to King Agrippa, King Herod Agrippa II. Herod Agrippa II, he ruled from approximately 48 to 73. He came into power at a fairly early age. He didn't really begin to be known as a governor or procurator or ruler until about 50. But that's due to some coinage that was made with his name and his resemblance on it, or his picture on it. Anyway, he ruled from about 48 to 73 AD. He was the last king of the Herodian dynasty. Agrippa II was the son of Herod Agrippa I, who beheaded James, as we talked about. He was great-grandson of Herod the Great. And his attitude toward Judaism was a little different than his forefathers. And he actually showed a superficial respect for the Jewish religious practices. And this is one of the reasons why he knew so much more about Jewish practices than some of the other previous rulers. Okay? He showed, like I said, a superficial respect. And actually, when you start looking into Herod and whatnot, you'll see references to rabbinic writings that actually paid him respect for the respect he gave the Jewish nation. Okay? However, he was relatively indifferent to the spread of Christianity. He didn't really give it a lot of attention. It's like, yeah, whatever. It's not a big deal to me. I'll hear you. Whatever. Move on. So he really didn't have a huge impact initially on the spread of Christianity. One of the things that Herod Agrippa II did was that he expended large sums in beautifying Jerusalem and other cities. He was a prolific builder, improved cities, repaved them, built sturdier walls, so on and so forth. And one of the cities, besides Jerusalem, that he had beautified was called Berytus, which is ancient or today's Beirut, Beirut, Lebanon. I bring this up because it didn't please the Jews that he was spending more money on another city than he was in Jerusalem. So, like many of his predecessors, he was given the right to appoint high priests in Jerusalem, which always worked out well when you have Roman law or Roman rulers appointing high priests. Remember a guy named Jonathan who'd been appointed by another Roman ruler, and then that same Roman ruler had him assassinated. So, yeah, it worked out real well. But he was given the opportunity or the right to do that. And despite his sympathy towards Judaism, he was not a popular ruler amongst the Jews, and he was eventually expelled by them, along with his wife, in AD 66, at the start of the first Jewish-Roman war that lasted between 66 and 73. Okay? Now, I bring this up because it gives you a mindset of who Herod is. During this war, during the Jewish-Roman War of 66 to 73, Herod sent 2,000 men, archers, and cavalry to support Caesar, Vespasian. Okay, against the Jews. He may have been a Jew in religion, but he was wholly, but he wholly supported the Roman Empire. He accompanied Titus, the son of Vespasian, on military campaigns against the Jews, and during a 7-month-long siege of Gamla in 66, he was actually wounded in battle. So Herod Agrippa II organized this 7-month-long siege of the city. Now, he was wounded and then had to return to Rome, and then Titus, Vespasian's son, took over and eventually captured the city. Now, I bring this up because what happened in Gamla was, I can't use the word foreshadow, but it was almost like a predecessor to what would eventually happen in Jerusalem in 70 AD. So Gamla was a city that was full of refugees. Basically, people who had been displaced by the Romans, a lot of them primarily Jewish, had been displaced by the Romans out as during this war. And the city of Gamla is actually really pretty interesting. I won't spend too much time on it, but it has a fortified wall that went around the city. But the wall was built between the houses. So basically what happens is that this is a small, relatively small town. Historically, it's tough to say exactly how many Jewish people were killed, but the number's around 10,000. That's a lot. Okay, so you have a relatively small city, and when all the refugees start to come and the Romans figure it out, they actually took stones from the fields and the surrounding mountains and built up the walls between their houses. And then they held off the Romans for 7 months. I mean, that's pretty impressive for a relatively small force to hold off the Roman army. And that particular siege was arranged by Herod Agrippa II. Herod Agrippa II, by the way, had a very close relationship with a guy that I quote pretty often by the name of Josephus, the historian, wrote the Antiquities of the Jews. A great deal of the information that Josephus had gathered had come from Herod Agrippa II. Okay? So it kind of gives you this opportunity to place him in history and place him in time. Herod actually had written several letters to Josephus, two of which are still, we can still read them today. Josephus kept them. All right. So that's Herod. Gets you a picture of who this guy is and where his loyalties lie while still being sympathetic to the Jews. Now let's talk about his wife, Bernice. Now, go back to verse 13 here. I want you to see something. He says, "Now when several days had elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and paid their respects to Festus." Now, it's funny. The New Testament has been shown to be accurate in every detail. Over and over and over and over and over again. Historically speaking, it is, not surprisingly, the most accurate historical recording of events we've ever seen. Okay? Yet it is still questioned, specifically in reference to King Agrippa and Bernice, because of the relationship that King Agrippa and Bernice had. Okay? So, Bernice was the sister to Drusilla. Anybody remember who Drusilla was married to? Felix. Okay? She was also the sister of Herod Agrippa II. I'll let that sink in for just a moment. In other words, she married her brother. Okay? Or at least had an incestuous relationship with her. Okay? And if you look in Roman history, and you look at commentators from that particular perspective today, they say that Luke is spreading the rumor that Bernice and Agrippa were married. There's all kinds of historical information to show that they were, but that's a whole other story. So, Bernice, she was first married to a person named Marcus. Then she married her uncle Herod, the king of Chalcis. If you look on your little chart there, he's at the top of the third column from the left. So she was married to a guy named Marcus, and then married her uncle Herod. Then, when he died, she married a guy named Polemon, who was king of Pontus and Cilicia, and he had agreed to be circumcised. But she didn't last very long with him either, and so she left him and then began an incestuous relationship with her brother, Herod Agrippa II. Then, later on, Bernice later became the mistress to Titus, who was one of Herod's best friends, when he became Caesar of Rome. Yeah, these are some good, upstanding rulers. I don't remember who it was I was speaking with, but it's we get what we deserve as leaders. And this just tells you how bad it was. At any rate, so these are the people that Paul is now going to get the opportunity to speak to. Okay? Let's pick it up here in verse 14, and we'll just read down through verse 22. Don't know how far we'll get after that, but we'll go ahead and read this. We'll pick them verse 13. So Acts 25, 13 through 22. Now, when several days had elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and paid their respects to Festus. While they were spending many days there, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There is a man who was left as a prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answer that it is not the custom of the Romans to hand over any man before the accused meets his accusers face to face and has the opportunity to make his defense against the charges. So after they had assembled here, I did not delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought before me. When the accusers stood by, they began bringing charges against him, not of such crimes as I was expecting. But they simply had some points of disagreement with him about their own religion and about a dead man, Jesus, whom Paul asserted to be alive. Being at a loss how to investigate such matters, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there stand trial on these matters. But when Paul appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, "I also would like to hear the man myself." "Tomorrow," he said, "you shall hear him." All right. So basically, Festus summarizes everything that's been happening up to this point. Okay? So tells him that Paul was left a prisoner by Felix, tells him that Jews from Jerusalem wanted a judgment against Paul, and that Roman law, of course, required that Paul would face his accusers. And during his initial investigation, it became apparent that the questions involved Judaism and whether Jesus was alive or not. Okay? Now, stop and consider for a second what we have recorded in Acts chapter 25 about what Paul had said and about the charges against him. We don't have a lot of detail there, but what we do know from Festus' statement is that Paul had the opportunity to tell them who Jesus was in one way or another. And maybe the Jews had done it for him. But Paul asserted that Jesus was alive. So to a certain extent, Paul had the opportunity to preach the gospel in that particular situation. Now, Paul, being brought before Festus is still like, I really don't know what to do with him. But he appealed to Caesar. And so at this point, he solicits Agrippa's audience. He wants Agrippa to talk to Paul because Herod Agrippa has a much broader knowledge of Judaism than Festus did himself. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We'll read through Paul's defense. We're not going to get into a lot of the detail today, I don't think, but we'll go ahead and read through Paul's defense here so that you get an idea of what it is that Paul was saying to him. So pick it up here in Acts chapter 25. We'll pick it up here in verse 23, and we'll just read the next few verses down to the end of the chapter. So Acts chapter 25, verse 23. So on the next day, when Agrippa came together with Bernice, amid great pomp, I love that, amid great pomp and circumstance, anyway, amid great pomp, and entered the auditorium, accompanied by the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. Festus said, "King Agrippa, and all you gentlemen here present with us, You see this man about whom all the people of the Jews appealed to me, both at Jerusalem and here, loudly declaring that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and since he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him. Yet I have nothing definite about him to write to my lord. Therefore I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the investigation has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems absurd to me in sending a prisoner not to indicate also the charges against him. So Paul has the opportunity, Festus introduces to Agrippa the situation. Doesn't have anything to write, calls all the prominent people together, and then Paul's defense begins. So let's start here in chapter 26, verse 1. Agrippa said to Paul, "You are permitted to speak for yourself." Then Paul stretched out his hand and proceeded to make his defense. "In regard to all the things which I am accused by the Jews, that I am about to make my defense before you today, especially because you are an expert in all customs and questions amongst the Jews, therefore I beg you listen to me patiently. So then, all Jews know my manner of life from my youth up, which from the beginning was spent among my own nation at Jerusalem. Since they have known about me for a long time, if they are willing to testify, that I lived as a Pharisee according to the strictest sect of our religion. And now I am standing trial for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers, the promise to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly serve God night and day. And for this hope, O King, I am being accused by the Jews. Why is it considered incredible among you people if God does raise the dead? So then, I thought to myself that I had to do many things hostile to the name of Jesus of Nazareth, and this is just what I did in Jerusalem. Not only did I lock up many of the saints in prison, having received authority from the chief priests, but also, when they were being put to death, I cast my vote against them. And as I punished them often in all the synagogues, I tried to force them to blaspheme, and being furiously enraged at them, I kept pursuing them even to foreign cities. While so engaged, as I was journeying to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priests, at midday, O King, I saw on the way a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, shining all around me, and those who were journeying with me. And when we had all fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew dialect, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads.' And I said, 'Who are you, Lord?' And the Lord said, 'I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But get up and stand up on your feet, for this purpose I have appeared to you, to appoint you a minister and a witness not only to the things that you have seen, but also the things in which I will appear to you, rescuing you from the Jewish people and from the Gentiles to whom I am sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the dominion of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those who have been sanctified by faith in me. So, King Agrippa, I did not prove disobedient to the heavenly vision, but kept declaring both to those of Damascus first and also at Jerusalem and even through all the region of Judea and even to the Gentiles that they should repent and turn to God, performing deeds appropriate to repentance. For this reason, some Jews seized me in the temple and tried to put me to death. So, having obtained help from God, I stand to this day testifying both the small and great, stating nothing but what the prophets and Moses said was going to take place, that the Christ was to suffer and that by the reason of his resurrection from the dead, he would be the first to proclaim light both to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles." Now, listen to what Festus says. While Paul was saying this in his defense, Festus said in a loud voice, "Paul, you are out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you mad." But Paul said, "I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I utter words of sober truth. For the king knows about these matters, and I speak to him also with confidence, since I am persuaded that none of these things escape his notice, for this has not been done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you do." Agrippa replied to Paul, "In a short time you will persuade me to become a Christian." And Paul said, "I would wish to God that whether in a short or long time, not only you, but also all who hear me this day might become such as I am, except for these chains." The king stood up, and the governor and Bernice and those who were sitting with them, and when they had gone aside, they began talking to one another. this man is not doing anything worthy of death or imprisonment. And Agrippa said to Festus, this man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. So there's a lot that happens here. I wanted to make sure we got it out there so you kind of get this picture of Paul being presented before Agrippa and Bernice and Festus and the leading men of the city and being able to speak forth the gospel. This is what Paul had been called to do. Super Dave, we are out of time, so can you save it for next week? Okay, so I wanted you to get this picture of Paul being in the courtroom, being before the judgment seat, being able to speak forth the message of the gospel, and all those people who are listening. And I appreciate Festus being like, wow, you're connecting a lot of dots here, you're blowing my mind. And Agrippa's statement, I think it was tongue-in-cheek. But all right, we'll stop there. I'm over time.